So this is talking with George Whitfield on 19th May 1981 over the phone from Cambridge to his home near Reading.
I assume you're taping all this.
Yes, I just started taping.
That's fine.
All right. And I'll stop after a minute or so to see how it's coming through.
Yes.
Okay. If you could tell me, first of all, what your educational background was and how you first came in contact with radio astronomy.
I was at school at Haileybury and Imperial Service College near Harford. Then National Service in the Air Force, learning to fly.
Yes.
Then went up to Cambridge, Trinity College, reading physics. Oh, natural sciences, part two physics.
What year was that?
Oh, dear. I'd have to look this one up. I think it was about 1950 to 1953.
Right, I think that's what I think you joined the group in 53, I think,
and
that's right.
I joined the group immediately after.
Right.
Immediately after my degree.
And on what basis did you join? Was it because of some interest that you had had in astronomy, or...?
Yes, I wanted to do research in physics, and I don't really know why I jumped for radio astronomy. It seemed the most interesting thing going. Now, I did know Ken Machin already.
Ah, yes.
Because we were both in the gliding club.
Ah, yes.
And we'd also had a third year lecture course on radio astronomy from, I think, Martin Ryle, but it might have been Tony Hewish.
Well, in fact, that reminds me that last night I interviewed John Blythe.
Yes.
And he gave that same reason that he had taken this lecture course from Martin Ryle, and he also asked me to pass on greetings to you.
Ah, jolly good.
Right.
If you see him again, pass him back.
Okay. But in any case...
likewise, any of my colleagues of those days.
In any case, you got interested in radio astronomy and joined...
I'd been interested in astronomy much longer, of course.
Oh, you had. I say, were you an amateur in your youth?
Well, not really. There was a telescope at Haileybury that I used a little.
Mm-hmm.
But it was difficult because it was outside the college and we weren't allowed out at night.
That does make it basically difficult, yeah.
So one could look at sunspots, but not much else.
Right.
But I had been sufficiently interested to acquire an astronomy book as my choice for a school prize.
I see.
So I had, a little bit of background of optical astronomy.
Right. But now when you joined the group, how was it decided what you were going to work on? Were you just sort of told that you'd start on a certain project?
When I joined the group, roughly speaking, my choice was that I joined the radio group, of which radio astronomy was only a part. And initially, I was told that I might be allocated to radio astronomy, or I might be allocated to the ionosphere.
I see.
And was told to go away and read up about the behavior of waves in media containing free electrons.
Yes.
Which I found very boring and very difficult. And I said very firmly that I wanted to do radio astronomy. But it was a matter of where Science Research Council grants were available.
Right.
And, I don't know whether I was lucky or what, but anyway.
But you did end up with Ryle's group.
I ended up with the one I wanted.
Right. And then how was the project chosen that you were going to work on?
I think for practical purposes, there were two or three of us, and projects were allocated.
Mm-hmm.
So really, it would be Martin Ryle's job.
Right. And what were you allocated?
A survey of radio stars at 38 megahertz.
Okay, which was, of course...
It ran straight through to the thesis.
Right. And along the way, you got involved in other things, which I want to ask you about. But
yes.
I'd like to get the flavor for what you did. Now, okay, you're told to do a survey, and you're given some idea of the way to carry it out. But were you pretty much on your own as to details of how to carry this out, or was there a lot of guidance from day to day?
Quite a lot of guidance. I think I wouldn't have known enough to have done what I did.
Mm-hmm.
The key things were the interferometer techniques.
Right.
And phase shift. What do they call it?
Phase switching.
The phase switch.
Right.
The idea of using a crossed interferometer.
Right.
With an east-west and a north-south aerial. That was given us. John Blythe, at the same time, started a crossed...
Well, the moving T-aerial, as it was called.
With a moving north-south.
Right.
But it wasn't a space interferometer.
Right.
In the way mine was. Presumably somebody's given you sketches of these. Mine's my pieces.
Yes, yes.
Now, somebody, I don't know who, suggested that my aerial might conveniently be made of a number of Yagis.
Mm-hmm.
And the original design of the Yagi came out of a publication somewhere. But then it had to be scaled up. So I spent quite a long time out in the field testing Yagis of various dimensions.
I see.
Until I settled on a design for one.
And this involved getting the maximum gain for the desired frequency?
Mainly getting sensible radiation patterns, good front-to-back ratio, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've probably still got the original notebook. Lots of plots. It was all done rather crudely, with a Yagi stuck up on a tube and turned by hand, 5 degrees at a time.
And what did you use for a transmitter?
The transmitter was an ordinary SIGGEN in the hut, which was a quarter of a mile away, fed to a dipole, I think.
Mm-hmm.
About 100 yards away from the Yagi. And then the signal from the Yagi was fed back into the hut to a receiver. And then the receiver output was fed back to the Yagi position again and spread, I remember, on an AVA.
Right.
So I was standing on a trestle in the middle of the field, rotating the Yagi, reading the aerial, and writing down the reading.
Right, so you were doing all this by yourself?
Yes.
Right.
For practical purposes. And so the original Yagi was made out of Dexia.
Ah, yes.
The little bits bolted onto the elements to adjust their length.
So having established a suitable design, you then had to go into mass production.
That's right. 28 or something of them.
Right. And that must have taken some time.
There was also the matter of designing the feed so as to minimize side loads. And that was rather left to me, how I did that. John Blythe had the same problem, and he came up with a different approach from mine.
This was the stub matches.
The grading, we used to call it.
What'd you call it?
The grading.
The grading. Oh, I see what you mean. I mean, in terms of grading the overall aperture, yeah.
That's right.
Right.
Yes.
And what was your approach?
My approach, having not very many elements, was to take the aerial as the sum of a lot of pairs, symmetrical pairs.
I see.
And it was fairly easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think John Blythe's mathematics were better than mine, and he took a more mathematical approach. Somebody came up with the Chebyshev polynomial approach, too. That might have been John Blythe.
Now, what about the receiver? What did you use for a receiver?
The receiver was provided. It was one of our standard 38 meg phase switch receivers.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have to make receivers.
Right. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you about was that you call this in your thesis an unfilled aperture interferometer. And I don't quite see what that means. It seems like all interferometers to me are unfilled apertures.
Ah, think of John Blythe.
Yes.
The thing which is simulating a rectangular aerial.
Right.
Now, that is an unfilled aperture because, in fact, he has not filled that rectangular area that he's simulating.
Right.
Well, my system, you have an interferometer that simulates two rectangular aerials.
Right.
But one end you only provide the north-south bit, and the other end you only provide the east-west bit.
Yes.
So that neither end is filled.
Yeah, I see that.
It's like a cross aerial, which is an unfilled aperture aerial. but with the two arms of the cross separated, so it's an interferometer as well.
Okay, so you would call the Mills Cross an unfilled aperture aerial.
Yes.
And then this is an unfilled aperture interferometer.
That's right.
I see what you're saying.
That's the terminology.
Okay. Now, I read in the thesis that you actually carried out three surveys,
yes.
The first of which had rather severe problems and wasn't used. Could you tell me about the nature of those?
Yes. Now, one of the major problems with the first one was ants inside the tubes.
It went
like this. The aerial feed was a twin feeder.
Yes.
Running down the inside of the tube on which it was mounted. Incidentally, you can probably still see one of these Yagis at Lord's Bridge.
Hmm.
They took them over there to observe the sun. I expect there are some still there.
Okay.
But the original feed, as I say, was down the inside of the tube, and then came to some sort of neat and tidy sockets from which one plugged feeds which ran to the main feeder and away.
Yes.
Now, we found that the effective length of those elements, of those inside leads, was changing. And looking inside, the tube seemed to be all full of mud. I think it was Graham Smith, said, "Oh, ants." And he was right.
They were building nests there?
They were building nests in the tubes.
I'll be darned.
And the solution, there were also little problems like water getting into the join of the dipole at the top.
Right.
Which was using standard television aerial equipment, standard TV aerial rubber blocks.
Right. Well, that's the one you mentioned in your thesis. You didn't mention the ants in your thesis.
Ah, well, perhaps the ants are more memorable and the ones at the top were more serious.
Right.
But we cured both by cutting away rubber and drilling holes and taking the feeder down the outside, and also going to feeder with a thicker polythene coat so that water on it had less effect anyway.
I see. But you found out about these effects only by actually carrying out a survey for several weeks?
Yes. I probably ought to have found these effects earlier, but,
well it's always easy.
You know what it's like being a researcher.
It's always easy in hindsight to see these things, right?
Yes.
So then they were corrected. And, well, I should go back before we go any further and ask now, at that time, what did you see as the scientific goals of this survey?
Well, at the time, the 80 megahertz survey, the 2C survey, was just going.
Right.
Indeed, shortly after I started, the first strip came out and was excitedly taken round to Martin Ryle at breakfast time.
Mm-hmm.
I think they'd been working on it all night. And the point of doing surveys at other frequencies was to end up getting spectra.
I see. So you are...
piece of the spectrum, so to speak, was to look at stars at 38 megahertz.
Okay, now,
John Blythe's was to look at the background at 38 megahertz.
Right.
Mostly.
But now, one point that I haven't been able to establish, I get conflicting answers on, is... Do you remember if, from the very beginning, at least when you joined the group, was it always the intention to do a survey at a higher frequency following the 2C survey for spectral information?
I think the feeling would have been for doing that. I don't think at the time people had got that far.
You mean they were just taking more of a wait and see attitude? We'll see how the 2C turns out. And
well, the 2C aerial was new; it was just up, it was running.
Right.
And really, one didn't need to think very much further ahead. We had 3 years' work to do on that.
Right.
I think it's very likely that Martin Ryle would have thought ahead.
Yeah.
Because he was planning the thing.
But as far as you remember, when was the decision made to to do the 3C, and what were the primary reasons for that, although you weren't directly a part of that, can you remember?
Oh, dear. Well, let's see what I can remember. We were converting the aerial to 400 megs, I think. That's higher than 3C, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. No, the 3C was something like 160 or...
160 or thereabouts.
It was twice the frequency of the...
Frequency. 2C. No, I can't put a date on that. It must have been immediately after the 2C, when we'd done everything which was sensible with the 2C.
Mm-hmm.
And a few other experiments using pieces of the aerial against each other.
Right. But do you remember the logic behind doing the higher frequency survey?
Oh, it was the obvious next thing to do with that structure. Having surveys at 38 megahertz coming along, a better survey at 80 done, the next thing to do was to use the next slot.
Primarily for spectral information on the sources?
Primarily, well, for spectra, and of course for the higher gain you get.
Right.
It may have been influenced by the ability to get decent head amplifiers at 160 megs.
What kind of amplifiers?
Oh, head amplifiers, I said. Amplifiers to go near the aerial.
Oh, I see. I see.
Yes, of course, you won't remember. We had little amplifier huts out at the main 2C aerials.
Right.
One hut each end, symmetrically placed amongst the aerials.
Yes.
And the cables ran in diagonally to it.
And those were referred to as head amplifiers there?
Those were the head amplifiers. And they drove the long aluminium coax cables. Aluminium helical polythene cables.
Well, the reason...
To the main hut, the main receiver.
The reason I ask this is that, in a historical sense, it turns out that the main function of the 3C was, in fact, to clear up the confusion problems that were present in the 2C. And
well, let's see, John Shakeshaft would tell you.
Yeah. Well, I've asked many different people, and like I say, I get different answers. Okay.
Certainly the higher resolution would have helped.
Yes, yes. I mean, that was the critical thing, just to have that smaller beam.
One thing that certainly came out was that they didn't analyze anything like so deep on the 3C survey.
Yes, yes.
The 2C was in retrospect, clearly analyzed deeper than was justified.
Right, right.
I think my survey also, probably.
Although you only accepted ones that were present in one of the other surveys, isn't that correct? As real sources?
Not, I think, in the thesis. In the published paper, probably yes.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to in the paper. Yeah.
Yes, if you compare the paper with the thesis, I think you'll find that I reject about half the stars.
Mm-hmm. Now, the first survey then was unacceptable because of these phase variations.
Yes. It didn't really tie up properly from trace to trace.
Right. And so you repeated it again. Could you tell me what your basic observational procedure was in terms of taking a day's worth of measurements?
Yes. To set the aerial, well, let's say at 9 o'clock in the morning, though it didn't really matter, to the chosen angle, that was a matter of going around and setting every single aerial.
Mm-hmm.
To set the phase shifts in the north-south aerial. The east-west aerial, of course, was never touched.
And those phase shifts were adjusted how?
By plugging in short lengths of cable. I think down to an eighth of a wavelength.
Mm-hmm.
And what calibration did we do? I can't remember.
Did you have a noise diode that...
From time to time, the receiver would have been calibrated against the noise diode. But I think the prime calibration on this survey was known stars.
Yeah, yeah. That's what Blythe was telling me last night, was the prime for his survey also. So basically, you had those as benchmarks. And in fact, that was probably how you determined that the first survey wasn't very good.
Oh, no. The big problem with the first survey was that the times of crossovers of stars didn't tie up.
Oh, I see.
And that's the clear indication of phase.
Right, right. Well, that's another way of saying that their positions weren't coming out correctly. The right ascension wasn't coming out correctly.
Oh,
yet.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
But now, having set this up, then you would just start the strip chart recorder and then didn't need to tend it anymore for 12 hours, is that correct?
Right. 24 hours.
For 24 hours, okay, you get the full sky.
Yes. And one ended up with a great stack of rolls of paper.
Which then had to be laboriously...
Which then had to be analyzed.
Digitized, so to speak. Although
I probably still got the sheets of graph tracing paper onto which they were transcribed.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a photograph in the thesis of a section.
Right.
Shows you the technique I was using.
But now, unlike Blythe, I don't believe you used the ETSTAT computer.
No.
For any analysis, so everything was done by hand.
That's right.
But now, when you say...
The computer was first used, I think, at Lord's Bridge on the first survey with the big aerial there.
Right, the 4C.
Yeah, it probably was...
In 4C. Right.
It wasn't the 4C when I was there.
Now, you say you traced the strip chart recordings.
Yes.
Now, it would seem to me that you would just simply want to read off values and more or less digitize them. That's not true.
Not quite true. One wanted to tie up from one record to the next one. Because the beam width, if I remember rightly, was about... The angles chosen were such that each star appeared about two or three times.
Oh, I see. So you only moved a third of a beam each time or something?
I only moved a third of a beam each time. And then one tried to estimate where the star was in declination from the magnitudes on the two traces.
I see. So you wanted to overlay these traces.
So the traces wanted to be overlaid. And the star which only appeared on one trace was doubtful anyway.
I see. And that was your primary means of getting the declination?
That's primary means of getting declination.
And then the right ascension would be from the envelope of the interference pattern?
Yes. There should be a maximum on the... there should be a clear central maximum.
Right.
And the position of that gives right ascension.
Now, you carried out two additional surveys, and what was the purpose? Why was there a third survey?
I think we were having trouble with radio interference.
In the daytime? I think that's what it said.
I think it was in the daytime. We were running up to a sunspot maximum.
So also with solar interference? You're saying?
Wait a moment. There would have been solar interference, too. Certainly, if we were running up to a sunspot maximum, you can easily check that. But
well,
I think it was an interference problem.
Right.
And so there were large blank areas in the record. And 6 months later, we could repeat it and fill them.
Right. Well, it was near solar maximum at that time. In fact, the IGY began in late 57 to coincide with
that's
that.
That's right.
With that solar maximum.
We had quite a lot of trouble with interference one way and another.
Well, it's of course a very low frequency and right in the middle of a industrialized country, so...
Yes, we also got around that time things like teleprinter transmissions from Iceland which shouldn't have got through because the ionosphere was so dense.
I see. Because of the solar maximum.
Because of the solar maximum.
Yeah.
The signal ought to have gone straight through the ionosphere and been lost.
Right.
But it wasn't.
Did you end up building special filters and this kind of thing?
No.
Just had to live with what came.
It didn't... I don't think it would have helped much unless we could have identified precisely what channels were troubling us.
Well, that's what I was thinking. If there were some bothersome transmitters at a particular frequency.
Yes. I suppose we could have done that, but we didn't.
Well, now, what would you say was the main scientific result of your thesis, of this survey, which in the published version was 59 radio sources at 38 megahertz?
Well, it wasn't any new radio sources, of course. It was just another piece of the jigsaw puzzle. And probably the valuable paper is more the paper on the spectra of radio.
Right, right. So this was really an input to that.
Yes.
Right. Well, okay, let's switch over to that subject, which, of course, was one of the main papers that you wrote, in which you calibrated the spectrum of Cas A rather carefully from all of the published values and then tied in, 31 other sources to that spectrum. It seems to me that this was the first time that anyone had tried to really do this. The previous spectra had been at most sort of three or four points. Is that correct?
I think that is correct, yes. I'd have to go back to the records and look. But certainly, spectra of the first four had been looked at.
The big four, yeah.
The big four.
Right.
But I came in at the right time for spectra, that the surveys that were going to give me the information were just coming up, and several of them were at Cambridge.
Right.
Which helped. And yet, nobody had done that particular piece of work yet.
Bringing it all together.
Bringing it all together. So I was in time to do it, but the information was becoming available.
Right.
And looking back, there were still few enough radio star papers for me to go back to the year dot and read all of them.
Exactly. Well, in fact, other people have commented to me who came in about the same time you did that you could basically read every radio astronomy paper in a period of 3 or 4 months or something like that.
Yes, I reckoned... I was just past that. It was Ken Machin who told me that one, and he was sort of 3 years ahead of me.
Yeah. In fact, I interviewed him just a month or two ago.
Yes.
Also.
He's a good chap, isn't he?
Oh, yes. And while I think of it, he had some nice old photographs from which I made some prints. Would you have any photographs, especially ones that would show people with aerials?
I've got some photographs, yes. I'll have to forage to see what I can find.
Well, that would be very nice if any chance of finding the negatives or only the prints?
There's a good chance of finding negatives.
If you would be willing to send them to me, then I could have our photographer here make some prints.
Yes.
That would be very nice, because I'm trying to put together an archive of old photographs, and I've built up a rather nice one. Anything to do with radio astronomy, but especially if they show people at work, and those are the hard ones to find.
Yes.
Everyone takes pictures of their aerials, but few people think about putting people in them for some reason.
Yes.
Okay, back to your work on the spectra. What do you think is the main contribution that this work on the spectra made?
I think the main thing I did was to bring it all together.
But in terms of an understanding of the sources... did anything become clear that hadn't been before? You talked about the splitting up into three types of sources, and they seem to have spectra which changed in their slope.
Yes, I moved out of radio astronomy about then, and I haven't kept up with that side of things, so I don't really know what grew out of that.
That was published in 57 in Monthly Notices.
Yes.
Of that article, but I was interested that in that article you didn't talk at all about the emission mechanisms, about the, in other words, the cause of the spectrum, except that you said that there was evidence of absorption by ionized hydrogen at the lowest frequencies.
Yes.
So that apparently that wasn't too much on your mind. You just wanted to...
Oh, no, it wasn't.
You just wanted to get the spectra out and let the theorist try to understand what was causing them?
Yes. I'm afraid my background of astrophysics is very poor.
Okay. And then also you had a paper on spectra at the Paris Symposium. Did you attend that yourself?
No.
Okay, that was given by someone else.
I'd forgotten I'd forgotten I had one.
Yeah, there's one in there, and it's basically similar to the monthly notices.
Yes, probably someone read the monthly notices paper or something
right.
similar
for me. But along that same line, did you have contact, it would seem like you might have it with this project, quite a bit of contact with other groups around the world?
I didn't have contact in the sense that I went there. We had contact in the sense that people visited Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
But most of my information, in fact, came from their published papers.
I see. And what about at meetings? For instance, did you go to the Jodrell Bank symposium that was in 55, I think, before the...
No, I would like to have, but there were too many of us.
So...
You know, we would all like to have. And broadly speaking, I was one of the most junior research students.
Okay.
So I didn't get picked.
I see. So it was pretty much a matter that you worked only with the Cambridge group and the visitors that happened to come to Cambridge.
Yes.
Okay. Now, there were some other odd projects, so to speak, that you worked on along the way, which came up.
Yes.
One of them had to do with lunar occultations. You had a paper with Elsmore
yes.
in Nature in 1955, IC-443, and also with Carmen Costain about the Crab Nebula occultation.
Yes.
Can you tell me about, first of all, whose idea was it to do these occultations and how it was that you got involved?
I can't remember whose idea it was.